Is made possible by KABU listener members and support from the Independent Publishing Resource Center in Portland, providing tools and resources to publish independent media and artwork, presenting the IPRC 20th anniversary celebration Friday, June 22nd at 6:30 p.m., featuring food, stories, art activities, and more. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com. More information at IPRC.org.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Daniel Peabody, the gallery director at Elizabeth Leach. He's here to talk about Lee Kelly's Six Decades, a show which runs through July 14th. Thanks for coming into KABU again, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
So Lee Kelly, he is one of our best known local sculptors, but with a national and international presence. Just tell us, he's been around six decades. Tell us some of the pieces we would all know around town. Because one of the first things I ever saw, even public art in Portland, was in the Rose Garden, the fountain with a big piece in the middle. I don't know what it's called, but
it's an untitled sculpture. So
where would people go in public to see some of these big steel sculptures?
Well, there's obviously the one at the Rose Garden you just mentioned. One of my personal favorites is a fountain that is outside of the U.S. Bank Tower, which we affectionately in Portland call Big Pink, right there on Burnside and the Transit Mall downtown. And there's a large stainless steel sculpture there. Of course, the one in the Rose Garden, there's another in the Waterfront Park near the west entrance to the Steel Bridge on the lower level for foot and bicycle traffic. There's two totem pieces in a planting there. There's actually about 35 sculptures in the metro area. There's also one called Memory 99 in the North Park blocks outside of the new Pacific Northwest College of Art on Gleason.
That's a big rusty one, isn't it?
Yes, correct. Yeah. It's a really important piece by Lee. He did a piece starting in 79 in the ninth year of each decade. So there was a memory two, which was from 79. There was a, you know, another memory piece, and then memory 99 was the piece from 1999, which was placed at PNCA through actually the funding from the Ford Family Foundation was enabled PNCA to purchase that piece and site it there. He's, of course, continued on and did another piece in 2009, which is out at his studio in Oregon City, which he has a beautiful 6-acre studio and sculpture garden in Oregon City. And it's there. Interestingly, in 2010, the Portland Art Museum did a retrospective on his work, and they actually published a drive, walk, and bicycle map to the metro area, basically from Salem to Vancouver, Washington. And they had, at that time, 33 significant publicly viewable sculptures by Lee Kelly on that map. And there's been a few more added since then.
33?
It was 33 or 30. Then. It was either 31 or 33 then. I didn't bring one of the maps with me, but we have some at the gallery. If someone comes in and sees our current show and they ask for one, we can give them one.
Okay. The map, of course. So in the gallery, up front in the main gallery, you have these big steel pieces. That's the contemporary work. And then in the back room, you have something from each decade, six decades. How old is he again?
Lee is 86. He was born in 1932 in McCall, Idaho, and he grew up there in Idaho and spent some time in the U.S. military. I believe he was in the Korean War and then settled in Portland and went to what at that time was the Museum Art School, housed in the Portland Art Museum, which is now PNCA, which of course is kind of why that Memory 99 piece ended up being selected for their collection.
So he's Mr. Portland, really, when it comes to sculpture.
He has had an active art practice in Portland area for more than 60 years now. He started off as a painter in the mid-50s and started doing sculpture in around 1958. And the early sculptures were very, very organic, kind of plant-like in certain ways, referencing those sorts of organic shapes. And over time, as he did larger and larger commissions, he did a beautiful gate for Candlestick Park, which in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, which of course is no longer there because Candlestick Park is no longer there. But he started doing these massive sculptures in the early 60s. And at that time, he kind of let painting fall away from his studio practice. But he has reemerged as he's reached maturity as an artist. But in the current show, Six Decades, there are five recent works from 2016 through 2018. Four of the five are in brushed stainless steel. So he welds, you know, these large sort of totemic stacks of different organic or geometric forms. And then, you know, one of them is 10 feet tall. Some of them are 9 feet tall, 8 feet tall. And then there's also one in a rusted weathered steel. Mm-hmm. There's when you kind of first walk in, there's two large pieces called Winter Song 1 and 2, and those are from 2016. And then there's also another pair of works called Tools of the Butter Trade. And in this case, he's thinking about the butter trade in terms of butter being fuel for butter lanterns in Nepal and India and Bhutan. He traveled a lot in Asia, and it was a big influence on his work. And so there's one of those in brushed stainless and one in corten or rusted steel. And then there's the newest piece, which was finished just weeks before the show opened, called Antigua 2, which is also in stainless steel.
So the forms, I mean, they're kind of totem pole-like in the sense that they're tall, and they have lots of different elements, but they're really interesting to me because whatever angle you look at them, there is always something a little off. Things step back, things overlap. It's very, he's sort of going against the grain of the shapes that he's putting together, and I think it keeps them, they're just very fascinating to look at and to move around. And is that a kind of thing he's, it seems to be a signature of his. He's been doing that particular thing for a long time.
He has worked geometrically for a long time. As I said earlier, he started doing very organic shapes, but over time, as the works got larger, they became more geometric, more formal. But these particular works, and in the last few years in particular, some more curves, less maybe rectangles and more curves have kind of entered the work. One of my personal favorites in the show is Winter Song 2, and it's actually, not only are they're sort of geometric shapes, but they also have this feeling of swelling in certain places, or of being, you know, sort of like the way skin has something underneath it. They don't just feel like a block of steel. They feel like there's something kind of pushing and pulling. There's a sort of a sense of maybe fecundity, or a sense of energy to them. That particular piece, Winter Song 2, as you walk around it, it's sort of different from all sides. And the forms do stack up in a way that doesn't feel exactly systematic. He talked a little bit in our conversations in the studio and the gallery with me about that, those pieces in particular, about them kind of referencing the kind of improvisational nature of architecture in certain places. Like maybe if you go see a Mayan pyramid, there's certainly a system to it, but there's also an improvisational element where the stones aren't all exactly the same size because they're made by hand versus, you know, made by a machine or a kind of a production process. And so with a lot of the work, he's looking at things that he sees in the natural world or in his travels, which he's doing a little bit less of now that he's 86, but he still definitely looks back at that and his memories of that. But and some of his actually his sketches, he's still finding sketches he did on trips years ago and then using those sketches from 10 years ago to make new sculptures now. Anyway, they are sort of they reference these things he's seeing that inspire him, and he then kind of reduces them down. They're not necessarily recognizable as a Mayan pyramid or a Nepalese stupa or something along those lines, but he takes elements of those and combines them in a way, which is one of the things artists do so well. They take these things they see that inspire them them, and they feel like they have a dynamic quality to them that is exciting, and they make something with that.
So the finish of all these pieces, that they're silver, steel, but he grinds the surface, so you see the sort of curly scratches of some kind of a grinder, and then they're covered in some kind of clear coat, right, to keep the rain off. And that itself is like, it's a very seductive surface, and then to see it out in the rain here, always different, but always kind of glowing and bright, even on a cloudy day. It's seems to be another of his signature looks. It's what I think of when I think of his work. And is that how those works are finished here?
It is. So of the five new pieces in the show, four of them are the brushed stainless steel. And it is. So he does have a studio assistant now. He's had an assistant for a couple years because he's getting a little bit older and isn't able to do quite all of the work himself. But of course, all the design work he's doing himself, he'll do all the sort of spot welding to get the pieces together himself. But he maybe have someone else do some of the seams or things like that that are difficult to reach, or the pieces are heavy or things like that. But the grinding, he's pretty insistent that the grinding of the surface is something that he should do, because it's something that he thinks of it as like his signature, and that the way, the kind of improvisational, jazzy kind of way he's doing this grinding, and he's very much inspired by music and jazz, that creates sort of a dance of light on the surface that gives it a lot of movement. And, you know, if you see one in the gallery, it's certainly evident, but in the sunlight, there is this, incredible gradation of reflection that changes as the sunlight moves across it. There isn't actually a clear coat on them. The large outdoor pieces don't have that. Some of the small indoor pieces do, but the brushed stainless, it's actually that sense where you feel like there's some sort of depth that looks like it might be a clear coat. That's a clear coat, excuse me. That is really a sort of an illusion created by the way our eyes are perceiving the light. So sometimes it almost seems like there is some sort of depth to the surface that isn't really there. It's just an optical experience because of the way he's doing the grinding.
So they are, the steel is open to the elements.
It is. And one of the pieces, Tools of the Butterfly 2, is actually a weathered steel piece, that's a rusted steel piece. And, that rust has come about because it has been exposed to the elements. I really love it in this show, having one, the two pieces, Tools of the Butterfly 1 and 2, one is in stainless steel and one is in rusted steel. And they are exactly mirror images of each other. Proportionally, they are the same. And one of the things that Lee's doing now is he's doing the drawings, and then he's computerizing the drawings for his sculptures. And then once the drawings are computerized, he can then give them to a steel cutter who cuts them with like a water jet cut laser type thing. So he can get the pieces that he needs to build. All the components can be cut kind of very precisely, as opposed to hand cutting them with a torch, which is how he worked, when he started off in the 50s and 60s.
I should just interrupt and say that these two pieces, Tools of the Butter Trade, so they're tall. One side has a very obvious kind of jagged side, like a sawtooth. And there's a sort of circle at the very top that could be a kind of a handle for your finger.
Yeah.
But these things are like 10 feet tall.
Correct.
And then they sit on a plinth that looks like a kind of a flower pot or a bucket. What is the tool that they use in Nepal, and what do they do with butter?
Well, I don't know that if you looked at this sculpture and you had looked at the tool that inspired it, they would necessarily look the same. But, what often happens is he will be traveling someplace like Nepal or India and, Japan even. We've had shows inspired by those places, or South America as well. But he'll do a series of sketches while he's there, looking at architecture, looking at hand tools, looking at different things. And then he'll bring those sketches back to his studio in Oregon City, which is a beautiful studio. We can talk about that a little bit later. But and then he will refine those sketches and come up with a design. So it's not that this is an exact, you know, 10-foot version of something you would see in Nepal. It's not like, the famous artist Klaus Oldenburg. It's not like it's a giant, shuttlecock from badminton in the middle of the lawn of the museum. It's a different kind of, it's more of an interpretation of the kinds of tools he's seen. It's been kind of funny. We've seen at the openings with the show, I didn't expect this, but I've seen a lot of people posing between the two jagged edges, because while they're identical, they're set up in a mirror image. So there's a kind of a rusted steel jagged edge facing a stainless steel jagged edge, and there's a space of a few feet in between. And I've started seeing people posing for a little, you know, selfies and things, like they're in like the jaws of something, you know. It's sort of hilarious. But that's how it is in galleries or museums. You don't anticipate people, the public, reacting to certain things in certain ways, but then they do, mm-hmm. and it's kind of fun.
But I think part of the what makes him popular and accessible is you can sort of see, you know, anthropomorphic elements in his work, or you can play with the abstraction and find things if you're not totally into abstraction. I didn't know that he named his things after things in the world. You know, I was thinking of him as Mr. Untitled.
There's a lot of untitled pieces, but sometimes the untitled pieces have, a parenthesis, or they're untitled for a while, and then he decides on what the title is once they're done.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Daniel Peabody. He's the gallery director at Elizabeth Leach Gallery. He's here talking about Lee Kelly, Six Decades, a show which is on now through July 14th. Some of the works we've seen before in the past were very heavy, big. I mean, he's using huge pieces of flat steel, almost like shipyard kind of scale. Do you think he had a Richard Serra phase?
Obviously the similarities that they're both working in steel. I think some of the early work from the late 70s, like I just mentioned, the piece, The Study for Elkhorn, or the piece R. Lee at the Portland Art Museum, or at his studio, there's a beautiful piece called East of Riggings that is probably never will leave the studio because the trees have grown up around it so much. But there are these forms that are sort of suspended, and there's this visual tension between the knowing that this huge slab of steel that's suspended in the air is you know, defying gravity because of the nature of the structure of the sculpture. I think the similarity I might say exists between Richard Serra's work, which are these huge torqued ellipses in Corten steel that you can walk inside of. I think the similarity is the visual tension where, you know, in Serra's work, you're inside these between multiple planes of tilted steel, and that sense that if this thing fell or shifted, you know, I'd be crushed. And that's something that Richard Serra, that tension is something that he has always had in his work. I think very famously, there was the piece that was made for a public space in New York, Tilted Ark, where that feeling of being unsettled around it actually so turned off the employees of the building that it was commissioned for by the federal government that they wanted to change it. And in the end, he said, no, you can't change it. And it had to be removed. This multi-million-dollar sculpture that had been commissioned by the federal government had to be removed because it so unsettled the people who worked with it. Lee's work is a little more playful than that. But I think the work of the late 70s, where the pieces are suspended, there can be a little bit of that. But it has less of a feeling of danger and more of a feeling of playfulness. Mm-hmm. I think the stainless steel piece at the Rose Garden here in Portland, you know, it's sort of feels like a temple. There are these vertical columns, not that I think he would, not that it has religious connotations, but it's these vertical columns with these horizontal planes kind of above, and then you're walking across this sort of designated path raised above water, and this sort of falling, you know, drips of water and spurts of water, and it's this really playful experience. even though, you know, those vertical or those horizontal planes that are above your head, you know, are huge steel, you know, pieces, you don't necessarily feel like they're threatening you, more like they're offering this opportunity to engage with them. Mm-hmm. And I think there are certainly similarities in terms of material between his work and someone like Richard Serra, but I think the feelings of intent are a little different.
Mm-hmm. So he's where he does his work is he calls it Leland Ironwork or Ironworks, sorry, in Oregon City. He's had that space for a long time. And now he has an assistant, you said, helping him with some of the harder, heavier work that he can't do now that he's older. Tell me a little bit about his technique, because I've interviewed him before, and it was fascinating how he would take a drawing, scan it, project it, get it cut, turn it into a 3D object. Just talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, so he's you got it pretty correct. He will sketch out an idea, and as you know, it might be and it's also a little different if he's doing it for himself, if it's a studio piece versus a commission. With a commission, the process is similar up to a certain point, which is that he will do a series of drawings.
Sorry, and how big is the drawing, the initial
drawing? The drawing might, you know, it might be the size of a on an 8.5 and 11 piece of paper, or you know, maybe bigger, maybe it's a 30 by 20 inch piece of paper, but it's not enormous. So he'll do a drawing that's a scale that's comfortable for him to draw freehand, and then that can be scanned and put into a computer program that will sort of standardize it, give it, you know, an architectural kind of way of mapping it. It might smooth out a hand-drawn curve if that's what he wants, and then that drawing, that digitized version of the drawing, can be scaled to pretty much anything he wants through either a digital process or a projection process, and then that can be marked out on a plate of steel, and it can be laser cut or water jet cut. And I think one of the things that's important is these to mention, though, is these aren't, you know, like a 2D cutout. He's cutting out, you know, 5 or 6 pieces to form a shape. So it's not like he's cutting out a flat sort of hand puppet, or like Kara Walker, you know, a black piece of paper that's a silhouette. It's more like he's cutting out components that he then welds together to make a form. So it's just, it's a way to sort of, it's a little shortcut, if you will, in terms of standardization. And then he gets a good clean edge. It's not a jagged edge from cutting with a torch. And it's a way for him to make sure all the joints are correct and things like that. Whereas some of the early pieces, actually, we have a beautiful piece, an Untitled Bird Study. I'm going to do a little tangent here and talk about this other piece and then come back to the process. But there's a piece from 1965 called Untitled Bird Study. And, you know, he was incorporating not only steel pieces that he was shaping and cutting himself, but also sometimes found materials, like a famous artist who did that, Mark DeSouvreau, would find industrial components as well as artist-made components and combine those. And in the 50s and 60s, Lee was doing that too. We did a great show a few years ago called Chrome, where Lee took steel or chrome plated steel bumpers from cars from the 1950s and welded them together with raw steel that he was using to make these really great organic shapes. Of course, that was a moment in time where he could get these chrome plated steel bumpers from cars. Now bumpers are made of plastic, so of course that wouldn't work for him anymore. But you know, in 1966 and 67, he was doing that. But to go back a little bit to the process. So once these things are sort of cut out, the current and the contemporary work, he can then spot weld and kind of put the pieces all together to create the form, and then either he or an assistant can go in and finish the seams and grind the seams, and then at some point Lee usually comes in to do the surface grinding because he kind of considers that to be part of his signature.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody walks in and falls in love with the piece, they can buy it. Are there any strings come attached? Does the gallery or the artist say you can't put it here, you can't do this to it, you have to show it? What are the rules?
There aren't rules necessarily. I think maybe the only rules, which are the same whether it's a sculpture or a painting, if you alter it in some way, it's not the artist anymore. We did have there was a situation a couple years ago where Lee had had been commissioned years ago to help design steel components that were built into a home, and then at some point that home was purchased by someone else and demolished, and they tried to sell parts of what had been made as Lee Kelly sculptures. And we, of course, said, you know, this isn't how it was designed. These aren't Lee Kelly's anymore. He did make this component at one point in time, but it's no longer a Lee Kelly sculpture because this is, you know, a fifth of what it had been, and it's just not his work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So intent is important, but I think in terms of what the rules are, there really are no rules. And if you people want the artist's input or the gallery's input into where a good place to site it would be or a good way to display it, you know, we're happy to offer that, but there's no real rules. And they're, you know, not all these 10-foot monolithic pieces. There's small 24-inch, 15-inch pieces that are great to have, you know, on your coffee table, mm-hmm. or on a bookshelf.
But the bigger ones, where do they end up in from the private buyers?
They end up in people's gardens often. We have many people, or a lobby a couple years ago, the Fox Tower decided they had been doing a program where they were putting sculptures in their lobby, which is a really large corporate lobby here in downtown Portland. But they had been doing these sort of year-long art rentals where they were having different artists put their work in, and through that process they included Lee Kelly for a year, and they really loved his work, and so they ended up going out to the studio and selecting a large piece that they felt was the appropriate piece to be their forever piece, and that piece was moved there. So sometimes it's someone's garden, or it could be a piece, the piece that's there is called Akbar's Elephant, inspired by the Mughal dynasty Indian king Akbar, and it's a beautiful, beautiful sculpture, and, you know, it had been designed to go outside, but currently it's living inside. So sometimes even the really big ones that you think will forever be outdoors end up, you know, in a corporate lobby or something like that. And I don't think you can see it as well as you used to because of the growth of the trees, but years ago, he did a piece called Arch with Oaks, which used to be visible from Highway 26 as you drove towards the coast, and it was a corporate commerce center, and at the time the developer realized that for the expense of building a big sign to identify the brand of that corporate park, he could, for the same amount of money, commission a legendary Northwest artist to build an amazing sculpture, and that's what he did, and so that became kind of the sign for that corporate park. Over the 30, 40 years in between, the trees have grown up. You don't see it quite as much from the highway anymore. But I moved to Portland 15 years ago, and you could still very much see it then. So, you know, sometimes they're commissioned and they're in spaces like that, and sometimes they're, purchased as studio works.
Well, I think someone at your gallery is going to have to update the map and maybe include all the private homes that have a Lee Kelly.
Oh,
that way we could... We could spot them as we go about our lives.
Maybe. That would be quite an endeavor. I mean, he is an amazing artist with 60 years of work. And so I don't know if we'd even be able to do that. But we do. It was funny when the Portland Art Museum published that map, I wanted to get some of them from them. And they were like, oh, they're going really fast and we're running out. And then maybe... So I ended up getting one and scanning it so we'd have a way to reproduce them. And then maybe a year later, a friend called who worked at the museum and said, hey, we're going to recycle a box of these. Do you want them? And I was thrilled to be able to get those. So when people come in and they ask, I'm happy to give them one of those. It's not 100% up to date, but it's pretty close.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Daniel Peabody. He's the gallery director at Elizabeth Leach Gallery, and he was talking about Lee Kelly Six Decades, which runs now through July 14th. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
All I know, I keep making this fooler. I stay protected. That blue steel it do ya. Yeah, my chick bad and I keep the Kill Bill. Yeah, born and raised, thoroughbred trio. Let's go, let's go.
Hey, this is Randy West coming from OSP at our annual Yahoo Sasa Talent Show.
Yeah, let me be clear about it. I got it. You way out of pocket. Go bring this shit here. Getting body back, tipping the bottle back. This is
this your boy TJ down in OSP, man. I'm telling you, rap music, you know what I'm saying? R&B, you know what I'm saying? Got a little bit of comedy up in there, man.
Y'all make sure y'all tune in June 25th at 6:30 p.m. Check out some of these guys from the OSP prison doing their thing, you know? We got a lot of acts and a lot of talent in here to share with the world, so just make sure y'all check that out. June 25th, 6:30 p.m. Prison Pipeline, y'all.
Tell me, baby, are we gonna let the elevator bring us down? Oh, no, let's go.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present the live broadcast for the 26th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music, Arts, and Food Festival. This three-day celebration kicks off Friday, June 22nd, with the Good in the Hood Parade and Festival continuing Saturday, June 23rd, and ending Sunday evening, June 24th. Good in the Hood is back at King School Park at Northeast Grand Avenue. Tune into KBOO starting Saturday afternoon on June 23rd for the live broadcast. More information about Good in the Hood can be found on the KBOO.fm website on the home page.
We're the fifth graders from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día martes 19 de junio. Funcionarios estadounidenses ya han separado 2.342 niños de sus familiares en la frontera con México a raíz de la política de tolerancia cero contra la inmigración clandestina, según informó este lunes el Departamento de Seguridad Interna al Senado. Este número corresponde al periodo entre el 5 de mayo y el 9 de junio. Anteriormente, el DHS había informado que entre mediados de abril y fin de mayo este número ya había ascendido a 1.995 niños separados de sus familias. Por su parte, el presidente Donald Trump dijo el lunes que Estados Unidos no se convertirá en un campamento de inmigrantes y culpó a los demócratas por rehusarse a negociar un proyecto de ley